That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
Well, that's what she said.
Welcome to That's What She Said, conversations with interesting people from the world of sports, music, comedy, and more, talking about their lives, careers, successes, and failures. Hey, everybody, welcome to the latest edition of That's What She Said with Sarah Spain. My guest today, Adam Amin from ESPN, and I'm going to let you behind the curtain just a little bit and say that we had technical difficulties when we first recorded this podcast, so he had to come call me again and re-record it. So many thanks to Adam for being so understanding about sometimes things just get messed up due to no one's fault that I will admit on this broadcast because it wasn't mine and I don't want to throw anyone under the bus, but technical difficulties can get in the way. And he was such an awesome guy for coming in and chatting with me again. And I enjoyed it because I got to talk to him twice and hear his really excellent stories of how at such a young age he's taken on such a big role at ESPN and some of the secrets to making it as a play-by-play color broadcaster. Those jobs are very tough and very hard to convince fans to be universally supportive of you when you're calling the game that they're listening to. So really great conversation with him, and I hope you enjoy this interview with Adam Amin.
That's what she said.
So happy to welcome in this week's guest, Adam Amin, a play-by-play commenter for ESPN. You can hear him on college football, NBA, college hoops, actually almost anything we do. We'll get to that later, the things he doesn't do for us and what he wants to do for us. But as of now, you can hear him doing play-by-play and hosting for almost everything across our airwaves. And he is from my home state of Illinois. So let's start way back there in Addison, Illinois. As a kid, did you have a sports obsession to the point where you knew that this is what you wanted to do?
I had the obsession. I didn't know that this was what it was going to lead to. I'm not one of those guys who just knew right away that this was, I want to be a sports announcer or anything like that. I thought I was going to be the catcher for the Cubs, in all honesty, when I was, you know, when I was like 7 to 8 years old watching like Joe Girardi and Rick Wilkins and guys like that play catcher for the Cubs. And that's what I thought I wanted to do. I wanted to be a baseball player. And then you realize like relatively fast that that's not going to happen because you're terrible at sports. So that's kind of how I realized that that wasn't going to be a thing. So I had the obsession, but I didn't realize this was going to be a career or anything like that until probably I got into like my senior year of high school and really into my freshman year of college. That's when I figured out, yeah, this is something that would be fun and it would be cool and it'd be awesome to pursue. And that's when it really became like a reality, like, oh, this is a career that people are allowed to go after. You don't just have to like be an accountant or a doctor or a lawyer or an engineer as my mother would try to drill into me constantly. So I'm glad that it worked out this way.
You have an interesting childhood, your father coming over from Pakistan and then needing to save money for a couple years before sending over for your mother and your siblings. But you were the youngest, right? So you were born here and sort of had a different upbringing than your older siblings.
Yeah, I was the first one in my family born in the States. And I definitely take pride in that. Like, I definitely think that's like a little bit of a badge of honor that I get to carry for my family, because those five, my three brothers, my mom and my late father, like they went through a lot. They went through a tremendous amount of adversity. Like the stuff I've dealt with in my life is very minimal. I've been a very lucky person. And a lot of that is because those five went through so much and sacrificed so much. So as the youngest of those four, they, like my brothers were very protective of me. They were almost like, other dads, like second, third, fourth dads in a way. They're the ones that like really had a hand in bringing me up and kind of getting me acclimated into life in America. And they're the ones who gave me my name. Like they all have very traditional Pakistani Muslim names. And they were the ones who named me Adam because they had gone to school in the States for about a year or so by the time I was born. And they had gone through the typical mid-80s ridicule of being an immigrant student in the United States. And they basically told, like, my mom wanted to name me after my dad. My dad's name is Muhammad, and my mom wanted to name me after my dad. My brothers were like, no, we're not going to do that. Like, let's not put him through that. And they were actually the ones who gave me the name Adam. So I take a lot of pride in that, and I know they do too.
So you've got these older siblings that sort of went through a bunch for you and parents that came over and worked hard to create a new life here. Were they very vocal about that, or was it sort of implied? And by that, I mean, did it feel like you were constantly being reminded of the struggle and that that was a burden on you to do something great with the gift you'd been given of being born here and not struggling? Or was it something that you learned just by observing?
I think it was something you learn by osmosis more than anything else. You see how, like, your parents' work ethic is in this country and, like, how hard they work and how hard, like, my brothers worked and everything that they wanted to use as an example for me. Like, they never really had to drill it in my head. But the things that they drilled in my head were the things that every other parent of any other kid is probably drilling into their kids' heads too. Go to school, get good grades, work hard, all that stuff. But when you see it in practice, as well as hear about it in principle from, you know, two people that have basically upended their lives in some ways for you and for better opportunities. And I mean, that's basically what my parents did. They kind of upended what they were doing in Pakistan for a long time. For you to see that, it gets absorbed pretty quickly. Like, just the amount of work they put in, the lessons that they teach you, the way they teach you to go about your business and how to treat people, and the level of respect that I feel like I saw them earn from the people that worked with them. It's very easy to see, like, what the example is for you. So I thought it was basically just implied. And yeah, I have, like, my parents definitely had, like, the stereotypical foreign parent, like, pressures, like, you know, especially when it came to school and things of that nature. And that's why I said, like, my mom just kept trying to get me to go down, like, the medical profession path. Like, you have to go be a doctor or engineer or something like that. Those are, like, kind of there too, but I just kind of knew what was at stake, because they put so much effort into starting a new life here. That's just kind of implied when you're around them.
Yeah. Was your family into sports, to the point where when you started to get an inkling that you might want to do this late in high school, early in college, they understood it and thought it was an admirable career, or was there some convincing that needed to take place?
There was definitely some convincing, more so with my mom and my brothers, and not like that they weren't supportive. Like, they were very supportive people, but they were just kind of like, I'm very whimsical about this job. I think I have, like, kind of a romanticism about this job and how great it is, and like, play by play is an art form, and there's kind of some magical moments that you can be a part of in people's homes and the intimate setting of radio, and like that did not register at all with my mom or my brothers. That did not register. My dad, it registered very heavily, because he got me into baseball. He was a semi-pro cricket player in Pakistan in, like, his spare time, basically. And when he came over to the States, the first thing he fell in love with was baseball, because it's like, oh, that looks like home. You know, that kind of reminds me of what it was like back home. So he became a Cub fan and turned me into a Cub fan. And that's kind of how we shared our bond, was through baseball. So he would listen to the radio and he would watch TV. And he had that feeling about Harry Carey and Tom Brenneman and Steve Stone, and, like, the guys that brought some semblance of home into, you know, his new life. He took that very seriously. So when I told him that I wanted to do it, he said, listen, if you want to do that, like, go do it. But the only thing he told me was, don't half-ass it. Like, if you're going to do it, like, go work at it to be great at it. Don't just do it because it's an easy way out or you don't want to do other stuff. Like, if you really want to do this, like, your passion better be driving you. So it didn't take a lot of convincing for him. It took a little bit of convincing for everybody else, to the point where, like, my mom would still tell people I was going to medical school. Like, she would lie to people, like, her friends, and tell them. Like, I remember I went to a wedding with my mom once. My dad was sick. So my mom was like, hey, can you go to this wedding with me? I said, sure, no problem. And this was, like, after I'd gotten my first job after college. And right before we walk into, like, this banquet hall, she goes, okay, I may have told some people that you are planning on going to medical school.
Oh, my gosh.
And you just haven't paid, you haven't picked out your specialty yet. So just go with it. I was like, are you seriously? Like, this is a thing. We're going to have to sitcom through this night now. So I had at least five people come up to me and say, oh, so your mom tells me you're going to medical school. That was
oh my gosh.
That was
what
one
did
of the
you
more
say?
Interesting.
Did you play along?
I said, I had to. I can't throw my mom under the bus like that. So I had to go along with it. And I'm like, yeah, you know, I just haven't figured out what specialty. I'm thinking about, like, maybe radiology, like whatever ology first came into my head. I'm sure I said six different things to 10 different people. I don't doubt that for a second.
That's really funny. I would say, like, the last maybe 4 or 5 years, my dad finally stopped saying, well, if it doesn't work out, you could still go get your master's at Northwestern. And I'm like, I think I'm good now, Dad. It's working out. Yeah, they just want the best.
He had high expectations for the Ivy League daughter, you know?
He did. He was like, oh, so we're just done with the Cornell? That's it? No advanced degrees? You chump? So you go to Valparaiso, and it feels like, based on your resume there, you knew what you wanted to do. You got a degree in television and radio. You were Indiana Collegiate Sportscaster of the Year twice. You were a finalist for the Jim Nance Award, which is top five collegiate sportscasters in America. You were essentially doing a job in college, getting the prep that a lot of people have to wait till they're out of college to do. How much did it resemble what you imagined it to be when you started doing it, even back in college, as the dream of kind of growing up and figuring out what it might be like to actually do the job versus watch it?
I think I realized during college that I really love the process of it. Like, I love the preparation process of getting ready for a broadcast, and the kind of butterflies that you get before you hit the air. Like, those were very apparent, and I still feel those things today. Like, I still love the process of getting ready for a game, and I still love those, you know, 5-10 minutes before you go on the air, and you have that little, you know, that feeling of nervousness that jolts you a little bit and gets you going. And I kind of always told myself that when I lose that, I probably I'm on the downturn of a career. Like, that's when I know it's probably not going to last much longer if I don't still feel those things. So I felt a lot of that in college. I did a lot of work in college. So handling, like, a big load of broadcasts now, it doesn't feel as daunting because I did a lot of that already in college. And I just kind of assumed that this is how you're supposed to do it. You do as many games as humanly possible. And to the point where, as long as you can do them without the quality of the broadcast suffering or the quality of your preparation suffering, then you should be doing as many games as possible. So that was just ingrained in me at that point. I do think that it probably prepared me better than I would have realized. And the other thing too, there are some people, and I'm sure you can attest to this too, and I don't know if you're this type of person, Sarah, but I think there are certain people in our business that are just so natural, and they just put on a headset, or they get behind a microphone, or they get in front of a camera, and it's just like, yeah, this is what you're supposed to be doing. I didn't feel that way at all. I needed to do all of those games, and I needed all of those repetitions so that I could kind of mechanize this and kind of just drill it into my head. I don't think I was a very natural broadcaster. I think I had to work at it a lot. And not to say that the people who come off as naturals don't work hard. I just think that they don't need as much fine tuning as others. And they can just go on the air and it just seems like they're meant to do that. And I think for me, I had to learn how to be really, really bad at it so that I can learn how to adjust those things and fine tune and fine tune and fine tune and eventually get to a point where I felt like I was good enough to do, you know, do some of the things we're lucky enough to do now.
What was your first gig out of college?
I worked in minor league baseball in Gary, Indiana. I had an internship, and I would show up at 9 a.m. I'd drive an hour from my parents' house in Addison to Gary, Indiana. Show up at 9, I would do game notes. I would help with ticket sales. I would help with merchandise. I would help with marketing. I would do stuff for the website. And then once about 4 o'clock or so rolled around, we would start getting ready for the game itself. So I would write out the lineup boards and do all the graphics for the pregame. And then I would get ready for the broadcast. And we would do the broadcast at 7 o'clock. I would do the middle 3 innings of the broadcast each night. We'd be done around 10:30. We'd stay to do all the postgame wrap-up stuff, photos and press releases. And come about midnight, I would get in my car, drive the hour back home and go to sleep, and then do it again the next day. And that was the entire summer after graduating college. And then I did a lot more of that when I got to Spirit Lake, Iowa. That was my first full-time job out of college. I was the sports director for a couple of radio stations in a small town in Iowa.
That is a long, long day. Do you remember either in those early minor league baseball innings that you got or even in college, any major mistake that still stands out?
Not any huge mistakes, thankfully. I didn't drop the F-bomb or anything like that as a sophomore. I did one time. I did say the F-word on air as a freshman, but during a morning show by total accident. Didn't mean it made it any less worse. Also, nobody was listening. That also helps.
That's good.
Totally
helps.
When nobody's listening and nobody can notice.
It helps to do them right early on.
Get all that out of the way. So other than that, I can't remember like a drastically bad mistake. They're always like little ones that compound and you remember them collectively. And I'm sure I've had more of those at ESPN that are more magnified because we're on national TV and we get called out, rightfully so, for a lot of those more often than not. But I don't remember anything just drastically bad that I still look back on and go, I cannot believe I said that. I can't believe I did this. It was just like bad calls and like my voice is cracked and things like that, more so than anything else.
I love that when Vin Scully was on the Lebatard show, he remembered one of his first errors and every detail of the player he was talking about and the play he was talking about. He tried to say hot shot hit foul, and the second word was not shot.
Yep.
But he remembered,
I don't doubt that for a second.
Yeah, he remembered the outfielder and that the guy, you know, had played in, you know, before and all this. I mean, all this detail. So it was crazy. It kind of gave you a window into Vin Scully that he remembered that like so many years later. So you were in small town Iowa, and I read that you worried a lot about whether you had made the right choice, whether this career was going to go somewhere. You drank too much. You were stressed. What were you worried about the most?
I think when you have like an idea in your head about how things are supposed to go and you hold on to that idea and you're so locked into it and you make yourself completely inflexible, anything that comes your way, any curveball that comes your way, any potential hurdle that comes your way, like I don't know if you react as well to it as you should. And that was definitely a problem for me. Like I had this idea, oh, I have to get to this level before I turn 25, and I have to get to this point before I turn 28, and I have to be calling this before I'm 30, and if I'm not, that means I failed somewhere. I screwed up somewhere, because look at these other guys that are doing, like, I remember looking at Spiro Ditas, who's a great broadcaster for CBS, you know, does the NFL and college hoops, and he was the Lakers play-by-play guy at, like, age 24. And I just thought, well, if I'm not doing that, then I don't have a future in this. Like, there's no way I'm ever going to make it where I want to make it. So when you have this idea set in your head and then things are not necessarily on that path directly or at the quickest pace possible, you go, well, clearly I'm screwing something up. And I think that combined with a little bit of the isolation, you know, first full-time job, I was 500 miles away from home. I'm from Chicago, and then I go to a town of 3,000 people. I come from a very diverse area where I grew up. I come from a very diverse city. And then I go to a place where I'm one of like two or three minorities in the whole town. And not to say that the town had anything to do with that. The people there were phenomenal. The people I worked with were amazing. And they're still friends of mine to this day. But there was something just about that feeling of isolation that had a lot to do with it. And I was working long hours, which I was used to, but it wasn't necessarily doing all the things that I wanted. I was doing tractor reports in Iowa, and I was at the men's expo talking about the new leaf blowers, and I was doing news shifts, and I was co-hosting a morning show about pop culture, and I'm not necessarily, you know, that's not necessarily my wheelhouse. I wasn't doing as many games as I thought I was going to be doing. So all those things combined lead to this weird idea in your head because you're so inflexible about what life is going to throw at you that you just assume you're doing something wrong. And I did not react to that very well. And I'm really disappointed in myself that I reacted the way I did. And I coped with it the way I thought I was supposed to cope by drinking too much. And I had a bad smoking habit and I didn't take care of myself physically. And I was doing all these terrible things. And I'm just glad that it worked out on the other side when I finally figured out, dude, like, deal with it. Like, this is part of being a professional. This is part of being an adult. You have to be able to react to things as cleanly as possible, and you have to be deft and flexible. And when you're dealing with those things the way I was dealing with them, it's probably not the way to go about it.
So was there a moment in time that you remember that was sort of a light switch of, okay, gotta just stop wallowing and work my way out of this? Or was it a gradual lessening of the drinking and the smoking and the stuff that wasn't serving you, and then eventually you came to sort of like a light at the end of the tunnel?
No, I think it was one night that really got to me. And I thought about it, and I actually wrote about this night. A friend of ours, Peter Burns, who works at ESPN and the SEC Network, was asking for some stories about how, you know, some of your bad days become your good days. And for me, I remembered it vividly because a couple of years back, I was lucky enough to cover the national championship game for the first time, college football championship game. And I was on the sidelines in Tampa, and I was just taken aback because I realized 7 years prior to that night in 2010, in January of 2010, I had a miserable night and I wasn't feeling very good about things. And I just gotten back from calling a basketball doubleheader, and I went to the same pub that I always went to grab, you know, the cheapest dinner I could and start drinking. And I remember going home that night, and I was just sad and I was just angry, and I wasn't feeling great. And I just started drinking. I had, you know, like a 24 pack of bad beer and a bottle of vodka, and I just started going at it. And I don't remember much about that night, you know, like the details of that night. I remember waking up outside, like half of my body was outside. I was laying down in a doorway. I lived in a basement of somebody's house. Basically, they turned it into an apartment, and that's all I could afford. So I ended up falling asleep in the doorway with like half of my body outside. I'm surprised I didn't get hypothermia. And waking up that next morning with like the worst hangover I've ever had in my life, and just kind of looking around and going, what are you doing to yourself? What are you doing with your life? Why are you acting like you don't have options? Like, it's, listen, there are people that have far worse problems than this, far worse actual problems. And I'm wallowing about having a job in the business that I wanted to pursue. Yeah, it's not an easy job. It's not the glamorous job, but that's not the point. Like, I kept telling myself, go be a professional. You said you wanted to do this, and you're not acting like somebody who deserves anything beyond this. And I think it was that night that kind of really opened my eyes a little bit more. And, you know, I started to focus a little bit more, and I started looking around for gigs that I thought might be more up my alley. Instead of complaining about the job that I had, why don't I try to change my situation or try to be better at the job I'm currently doing or whatever it may be? And that was a night that really helped shift my attitude a lot.
Hey, everybody, don't forget to go to ESPN and Apple Podcasts and subscribe to That's What She Said with Sarah Spain so you always have the latest episode. Don't forget to rate and review it as well and tell all your friends how awesome it is.
So, as you said, this was sort of one of those, like, aha moments. Was it just right after that you completely rehauled? Or what specifically did that night, that moment, cause you to do action-wise to change your circumstances?
Yeah, I think it was a lot of just reevaluation. I think it was waking up and going, what are you doing? What are you doing with your life? Why are you reacting this way to your circumstances? And I think it was just an eye-opening night and an eye-opening moment to look back and say, you know what, this isn't healthy for you, and this isn't the right way to go about things in terms of your approach and in terms of how you are mentally and how you are physically, and just it's not a bad time to change how you go about those things and to change your, just change the idea as to how you want to think about your life. And I don't think that's professionally. I think that's personally. I think that probably encompassed a lot of different areas of my life, and we got to that point where I just wanted to use that night is kind of a launch pad and to say, you know, we're not going to hit that. If you want to use the term rock bottom, I guess that's rock bottom. And you just kind of work from there and say, well, there's only up to go from here. And let's avoid approaching things the same way we approached them that night.
Well, and not only, I mean, you said not professionally, but am I right in assuming that once you hit that sort of rock bottom, you said, I shouldn't be reacting this way to this job and my life, which means I've either got to change just my actions or the things that are causing it. And this maybe isn't the place or the job for me.
Yeah, I think you realize the circumstances maybe aren't conducive to what you want to do eventually. And listen, it's never I never wanted to be the person who is upset about having an option. Everybody's got an option. And, you know, as I've said before, like, there are other people that have far worse situations than the one I was in. So I think recognizing that and being cognizant of that and appreciating what you do have and appreciating that you have the ability to make a choice and to change your mentality and to change your approach, like, that's an option. You have that choice. And I get that not everybody feels that way. And, you know, there are plenty of people out there that battle that on a consistent basis. They battle that, whether it's diagnosed or not. They battle that internally. They battle that mentally. They battle that within themselves. So I understand it's not the easiest thing in the world to do for everybody. And maybe that's not something everybody can do. But I realized that I was lucky enough to be in a situation where I had a choice. And I never wanted to be upset about, like I said, having options. You have options. You have choices. So I think realizing that my actions needed to be better, and maybe I try to put myself in a position where I'm happier, where the quality of life is better for me personally in that state. Like I said, it had nothing to do with the place or the people. It was just how I was feeling at that time of my life and how I was feeling that at that point professionally. And I thought, well, let's try to find something that we're really passionate about, we're really happy with, focus on a point of the job. If that's what's upsetting us, then let's focus on a point of the job that really gives us joy and makes us happy and makes you feel like, yeah, this is something I want to keep pursuing because I derive joy from this. So let's put ourselves in a position to feel that way on a more consistent basis. So I thought, I think that was the time where I realized I wanted to go find another job and change of scenery, and hopefully that would be enough for a change in mentality.
Yeah, so let's talk about how you get from the minor league baseball, where you're just maybe not sure if this is all it's cracked up to be, the dream job that you had envisioned, to, you know, getting your foot in the door at ESPN. What were the steps?
Gosh, there are a lot of them, and it started with Ian Eagle of CBS. He, for whatever reason, kind of took me under his wing, and it was just one of those weird, strange happenstance moments where he would run a sports broadcasting camp with a friend of his out in New York and out in New Jersey. And the team that I happened to work for was one of the like camp spots for their camp. And they would bring all of their campers over to the ballpark for a couple of days to, you know, kind of put them into a professional situation. And he had asked me, hey, would you mind talking to my campers? And I'm not going to say no to that. Like, this is a respected professional in the business that I want to pursue. And I said, of course, I would love to. And for whatever reason, and this is still stuff that I don't know how to explain, but he took an interest in me and took a liking to me and decided that he was going to invest a little bit and said, no, if you ever need anything, if you have questions, if you need somebody to listen to a tape, it was that person reaching out, making you feel like what you were doing was good and the work that you were trying to put in was solid and just giving you a semblance of confidence. And for me, that was important enough to feel good about what I was doing, and I wanted to pursue that. So that's how that relationship started. I maintained that relationship for a long time, and it's one I'm still very happy that I have in my life. And he basically ended up guiding me in the right direction to find somebody who could represent me. That led to more freelance work. That led to putting together a new resume tape. And eventually that led to the person who now represents me putting that tape in front of Dan Steer, who was at ESPN at the time, is now over at NBC. And just seeing that tape for him, he saw it and said, all right, let's give him a shot. And that's another thing I'll never really understand, how he decided to take a risk on somebody who had very little experience and very little knowledge and was probably very raw in a lot of ways, and putting him in a position to say, all right, let's give you a shot. Let's see how it goes. And just somebody taking a risk on you, and then another person, and then another person, and there I was. It eventually led to me getting hired at ESPN.
And that's so frustrating, I think, to people starting out, is that whole, it's not about what you know, it's who you know, right? And then you're like, well, how do I know people? And so you give them as many examples as you can of networking and take every job possible and go to conferences and join groups and reach out on social media. But you're a perfect example of, yeah, I mean, you have to get in front of people. And then once you do, you have to impress on them that you're worth taking a chance on. You were young when you got to ESPN. I know you did an internship at ESPN 1000, and it was before I got there. So even though I've had been racked with guilt that I didn't remember ever interacting with you, it was because
I'm glad
it was
we got to the bottom of that.
Yeah, it was
a year or so before
I got there. I was like, oh my God, I must have been such a bitch. I like don't even remember interacting with him. But you were in fact there before me, so that's good. But yeah, you did the ESPN 1000 internship. Now you get this big opportunity. And, you know, I always talk on the pod about imposter syndrome and this idea of there are some of us who maybe naturally are overconfident and show up and feel good for things we're not qualified for. And then those of us that are perfectly qualified and show up and worry we'll be found out for not being good enough, not being ready. When you got that first opportunity with ESPN, where were you on that scale?
A complete fear of exposure, I think, is what it was. I think I was just petrified of being exposed to some punk kid who had no business being on TV, and I probably was a punk kid who had no business being on TV, but I took the route of don't overstep any bounds, lean on the people around you, and kind of learn your way through it and learn how to be bad at it before you feel confident enough to try to be good at it. So, again, I was lucky. I had really smart people. I had a great producer the first time I went on air. I had easygoing analysts and people that were good to have in that moment. Like, I had a very anal producer and a very, almost overly thorough producer. And that was probably good for me, not really knowing what the details were, and to have somebody as detail-oriented as I had. It was probably just a good mix, and it helped me feel confident knowing that I could lean on him and not have to be completely aware of every single television mechanism that veterans are aware of. I didn't know all those things. So I think it worked out well in that way. And over the course of my first few years doing games, it wasn't a lot of high profile stuff, and nor should it have been. I wasn't ready for that. And I think whether it was on purpose or not, the people at ESPN put me in a position to be bad at it and to screw up and to make mistakes, or to at least be in a spot where I knew if I made a mistake, it wasn't going to be the end of my career. Because again, I came in with just a pretty significant fear of exposure. So I just didn't want to screw anything up. So I think I was in a position where I didn't have to worry about that as much. So I treaded very softly for my first few years at ESPN.
You know, I had Kevin Negandhi on a couple weeks ago, and he was the first, you know, sports anchor on a major network of Indian descent. And he said he felt incredible pressure, not only to represent himself, but all people of Indian descent, because there hadn't been that representation. Has that ever been a part of your story? Or does it feel like you had enough people come before you that it doesn't weigh on you as much?
I think I do feel it now. And probably more so than I have, because I do have people reaching out and saying, it's cool to see somebody who looks like you do what you're doing. So I don't think of it as a responsibility. I kind of just play it by ear. If somebody has a question, if somebody is curious, if somebody wants to reach out and ask how did you get there, or you know, what the process is like, I'm always happy to discuss it. You are to other people what they want to make of you. You can't, you know, you can't always control what people perceive of you. So if somebody says, I look up to you because of your skin color, and it's somebody that I haven't seen do that, and that is relatable, then that's what they see you as, and that's something you should embrace. But at the end of the day, I just want to do a good job. And if you do a good job, I think people will respect that, and then they can feel like they're able to relate to you on a more personal level, rather than just, oh, I see this person, so I'm going to naturally gravitate towards them. I hope it comes from a place of, he's good at what he does. Oh, and by the way, it's cool that he and I have a similar background. So I don't necessarily feel the pressure of it. But I am aware of it, and I'm much more aware of it now than maybe I ever have been.
Who did you watch and study to learn how to do play-by-play?
Man, a lot. I mean, there's an incredibly long list. I mean, it started locally in Chicago for me, you know, and just having, even watching somebody like Harry Carey, as surly as he may have been at times on the air, and especially in his later years, how, you know, how at times his broadcast could be very mistake-filled. You just appreciated that he had a connection with a fan base and that he was still, it seemed like, enjoying what he was doing for a living. So you take, you understand that, and you remember the feeling you get as a kid or as a fan watching a Cubs game and thinking, oh, Harry, like you, even if he says something outlandish or incorrect, you at least understand that it's coming from a place of joy. So that was important to me. Listening to Pat Hughes on the radio, the voice of the Cubs, and learning what the mechanics are of a baseball broadcast, listening to Jim Durham when he was in Chicago and eventually when he was the lead voice for ESPN Radio doing NBA games. You know, those are the guys that I grew up to start with. Wayne Larrabee is another one who is still the voice of the Green Bay Packers and was the voice of the Chicago Bears when they won their Super Bowl. Taking in the local guys and then expanding your palate, so to speak. You know, watching Brent Musburger, what made him relatable to a fan. Watching Brad Nessler, watching Joe Tessitore when I really became a student of watching broadcasts. Mike Tirico, watching Ian Eagle, somebody, like I said, who has a great influence on me. What type of point guard Dan Shulman is on the air when he, you know, really goes out of his way to set up his analysts. There are so many great announcers that we have, and that doesn't even scratch the surface of the people we have now that are, you know, great role models on TV and on the radio. But you take a little bit from everybody, and you take the positives from everybody that you think are in sync with what type of person and what type of broadcaster you are and what type of voice that you're developing, and eventually you find that voice. But you kind of have to crib note at first, because there's no real your own self doesn't have a blueprint for how to do this, so you kind of have to crib note from everybody else.
Yeah, there's that. You have to start out a little bit with mimicry until you find your own voice. And of course, you do have to eventually find your own voice. You can't just be a replica of someone else that you admire, but combine it with who you are. And what's interesting about play-by-play and color is that they are it's very difficult in those jobs to be universally beloved because people don't get to choose you. If they want to watch the Bears preseason, and we're going to get to that, it's going to be you. If they want to watch the Cubs game, it's going to be, you know, Len and JD. You're what they get. And so how do you think you can at least look around at the ones that are the most well-liked of that job and pick what it is about them that they're doing right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anybody's universally loved, but I think as close as you can get, I look at somebody like a Doc Emmerich who does a phenomenal job on the NHL for NBC and seems to be a very universally respected and liked broadcaster among peers and fans. And I think it's the way it's almost like you're watching like your next door neighbor or your uncle like tell you a story about somebody that you have a vested interest in. And he tells you a story about somebody and you feel connected to him. And in turn, you feel connected to the broadcaster because they're the person that told you this one story. I think he does that as well as just about anybody. I think, like, just watching what Mike Tirico does and all the different sports that he works on, whether he was at ESPN or now at NBC, there's a relatable quality to him, kind of like an everyman feel. And he's a smart guy and he's a very good broadcaster, but there's a relatable feel to it. And I think that I think there's a lot of people who really appreciate that. I know on the college football side, and I know we're going to miss him, but, you know, Joe Tess, when he was doing college football, fans really enjoyed him because they felt like he was the liaison of the fan to the game. Like, the way I feel when a big touchdown gets scored late in the game is how Joe would show that and express that on the air. And I think that's fair. I think fans really respond to things like that. I think Mike Breen, who does, you know, as good of a job in the NBA as anybody ever has, he is so well prepared and he knows the league so well. He knows the rule book so well. So when anything happens, whatever the situation, whatever player makes a big play, whatever rule needs to be explained, he's always there with the right answer or the answer that's going to make the fan feel the most at ease. And that's something that fans respect. So whether it's likability, emotional expression, preparedness, I think all those guys have some element of that, and it makes them relatable and easy to root for and easy to connect with. And that's all you're looking for at the end of the day, is some kind of connection between yourself and the fan at home on their couch, or the fan at the bar, or whatever it may be. You're just looking for some kind of connection that's going to make the fan feel comfortable watching you and your team do a game on the air.
You've done almost every sport. What's the toughest one to prep for, you think?
I still think college football. It's, you know, the depth and breadth of knowledge that fans have, the amount of players that are on a roster, because it's not like a uniform sport, so to speak, in terms of how the postseason is determined. There's so much debate and argument and speculation and so many moving parts to it that, you know, you really have to be well-versed, and fans are very passionate and opinionated about it, and just the depth and breadth of, you know, the people, the personnel. I think that's probably still the hardest sport that I work on to prep for. Baseball can definitely be tough, just because of the same reason, the breadth and depth of the history of all of it. But I think college football, with as passionate as the fans are and as knowledgeable as they are, and with the amount of information and personnel out there, I still think that's probably the toughest to prepare for.
Let's talk Chicago Bears preseason. This is the team you grew up watching. You and Kyle Brandt are going to do the preseason games, the call for the local television. So all the Bears fans watching are going to get you too. What does that mean to you to get to call your team?
No pressure, right? I mean, you grow up rooting for the team.
And preseason, so you have to know, like, the sixth guy on the depth chart that's going to get cut after this game.
Yep, I need to know guy number 89 on the 90-man roster. And that's, there is definitely pressure in that, because it's a very particular fan base, and it's a very passionate fan base, and that's a whole city that's uniting. I feel like the NFL in big cities has such a uniting factor because of how large these metropolises are. And when you have a team that kind of brings everybody from each side of the town together, there's going to be a high level of passion in that fan base. So there is some pressure in that. And it is the team I grew up rooting for, and it is the team I grew up watching, and it is the team I was invested in. And I was that guy watching the fourth preseason game to see who the 53rd guy on the roster is going to be. So I know how fans feel about it, and that definitely adds to the pressure of it. But it's also like, come on, how great is that? You get to call games for your hometown team. You get to basically introduce the team to your fan base and get them ready and excited about a season that's coming. So I think there should be a lot of excitement, and I know I'm feeling very excited about it.
I'm currently wearing a Mitchapalooza shirt, so I am, and that is not a joke. I'm ready. I'm ready for it. I'm ready for at least 5 wins. Is that thinking too big? I mean, I just want more than 3.
I don't think that's too much to ask.
All right, good. I learned a lot when I was logging games at my first job at Fox Sports Net, and it made me respect and know more about sports that I originally hadn't cared much for. What sport changed the most in your mind by calling it?
I think women's basketball. I think, and I understand we had as great of a Final Four as there has ever been played in the last year. I understand that, so I say that with that caveat attached to it. But I think people go out of their way to kind of just poo-poo a sport that they're not heavily invested in. And I'm not accusing anybody of anything here, but I think most of us know why. That they kind of shun women's basketball, whether it's professionally or in college. And I'm not one of those people. I don't have that idea in my head. I call plenty of women's sports, and I enjoy them thoroughly because it's part of the job, and I enjoy the job. But to really see how great these players are on a consistent basis and at a high level and on big stages, and then having kind of observed the WNBA more so this summer than I have at any other point, and just kind of appreciating it for what it is, the same way that, I mean, we talk about NBA players are so supportive of WNBA players, and just, they're like listen, ball is ball. Like, we respect who can play. And that's what's the most important thing. So I don't know. I don't understand why people go out of their way to kind of, you know, just look another sport off when there's no reason to. And I just feel like if people would take some time to watch it with a critical and objective eye, they'd probably appreciate it more. So I came in with no expectations. I just knew I had a job to do with a great crew, and I just grew to appreciate the sport that much more. And again, when you're around players and coaches, you're going to become more invested in it. That's just human nature. So that, I'm sure that's part of it. But, you know, I just, my respect level for the sport, which was already intact. It's not like I'm not making some kind of big turnaround story here. But for me, just my respect level for the athletes was that much higher after having gone through an entire season and being invested in the sport.
I have my opinion on the best call I've heard you make, but maybe I'm biased. What would you say is one of your best calls, your most memorable calls?
I mean, it's hard to beat the Final Four. I mean, just with the stakes and the stage and, you know, the fashion in which it happened. I mean, every announcer kind of dreams of a moment like that. Everybody wants to call a buzzer beater for a national championship, and that's not something you can train for or practice or, you know, anything like that. It's just you hope that you're in the right place at the right time and you don't screw it up too badly. And, you know, whether it's that or, you know, LeBron James buzzer beater in game 3 of the playoffs against the Raptors this year, like, all you hope for is to be in the right place at the right time and then to try to encapsulate the moment. So I think those two, which came within a very short amount of time of one another, I think within like a month of one another, to have moments like that, that's all you kind of hope for. And we were just lucky to be a part of that when those moments presented themselves. But those are the ones that are going to be, like, I'm not going to forget those. Like, those will be ones that stick around for a long time in my own memory.
Well, and when it's someone like Arike Ogunbowale that people may not know her name or that team as well, it's always going to be connected to you because that's the moment they know of her, right? LeBron James has had a lot of game winners and a lot of great moments.
Yeah.
You will always be, that clip will kind of be her career until she tops it, which I don't doubt she will at some point. But what about the worst call? Have you ever just blown it?
I don't think I've blown it completely. I've had moments where I just go, man, I didn't really say anything there. I just kind of made some kind of guttural noise. I think, I was doing like a Rutgers Seton Hall game, one of my first years at ESPN, and it went to overtime, and a guy hit a three. I think it was Jerome Steers hit a three with like 6 seconds left to tie the game. And I just kind of just made a noise rather than saying anything. like words escaped me. Words didn't feel like showing up at that point. So it was just like random, like, stomach noises being made through a throat. Like, that's what the call probably ended up sounding like. So I don't think I've blown it completely, but I have probably had moments where people went, What was that again?
and finally, what's the dream gig? What the pinnacle for you to call?
You know, this is kind of the dream gig right now, right? Like, just doing the job itself is the dream gig. All you want to do is just do bigger and more impactful games, right? We all want to be a part of a championship call, and I've been lucky to be a part of a couple in some capacity. But at some point, you know, you'd love to do the main broadcast of the college football championship. You'd love to be, you know, doing the World Series on TV or radio. And you know, for me, I love doing the NBA as well. Like, we'd all like to be a part of those biggest games when the moments are at their biggest. So that's just part of it. But it's, like I said, if you try to think of it in that scope, it's nice to kind of step back once in a while and think of it that way. But in the micro of it all, you don't want to think of it that way because you could probably just drive yourself nuts.
All right, before I let you go, you have to do the one thing that everybody does and nobody expects.
Didn't expect the kind of Spanish Inquisition. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
That's right, it's the Spanish Inquisition. Number one, what's the natural talent you wish you were gifted with?
God, you know what? Is it a natural talent to be able to cook? Because I can't. Like, I don't know if that's a natural talent or not.
Well, if you've tried and you still can't, then yeah, you lack whatever ability it is to learn.
I lack it significantly.
Number two, what's your desert island album? You can only have one.
Oh, man, that's a great question. I think it's a tie of what my older self says it should be, like something from the early 90s. I would say maybe, I would say Nevermind by Nirvana is probably one of the great ones.
Nice.
But I feel like there's got to be some kind of Jay-Z album, you know, whether it's like the Blueprint. Like, I think there's something close by, like in that realm, that I think might be pretty fitting as well.
If you could switch lives with anyone for a day, who would it be?
I would love, you know what, I would love to switch spots with the president. I would love to switch spots with the president. I want to know what whether you agree with him politically or not. Like, I just want to know, like, what's that seat like? How does that process work? I mean, I understand it's not the easiest job in the world, and the pressure is as high in that job as anything on the planet, but I'd just be curious, how are you making some of the decisions that you make?
So are you good at golf?
Terrible. Terrible. Terrible.
Number four, what's the most scared you've ever been?
I almost drowned when I was younger. I think that was probably the most scared I've ever been. I'm not a great swimmer. So like just being out on large bodies of water definitely freaks me out. So there are moments like that for sure. But I think probably like when I almost drowned as a kid.
In a pool or an ocean or?
It was in a pool. Like, I feel pathetic. I feel pathetic saying it was in a pool.
Don't feel pathetic. There's a lot there. It's actually really sad how the high number of kids that drown. It's
yeah,
really...
and I was like, I was 6 years old. I jumped off the diving board because I thought I could. And I just, like, it was not a great decision on my part. So, yeah, I was very
Yikes.
Frightened of that moment.
Scary. Number five, what's the most embarrassed you've ever been?
Okay. This did happen on the air. it's on Deadspin, so people can look it up. It's not when I dressed up as a president. It's not when I dressed up as George Washington on national TV. That was actually pretty fun. But we completely botched Fred Taylor, identifying Fred Taylor on national TV.
Oh, no.
And it was like we had a camera person that said, we were doing Kelvin Taylor's high school game. Kelvin is Fred's son, went on to Florida to play running back. And we were told by a camera person, we have the guy. We have his dad. He's here. I've seen him before. I hadn't had a chance to meet him prior, so I felt, you know, I wasn't properly prepared on it. That's totally on me as well. But we went about 2.5 quarters just misidentifying the wrong guys as Fred Taylor, like Jacksonville Jaguar Hall of Famer Fred Taylor.
Yeah, that's tough.
And we ended up having to, like, go back and show somebody else, the proper person, go, oh, there's Fred Taylor. Sorry, we misidentified the wrong guy, and then just, like, completely burst past it.
Oh.
And by the way, the person we ended up showing was, like, Cleo Lemon, former Miami Dolphins backup QB. So that ended up being kind of a fun coincidence about it.
Number six, what would you consider your biggest failure?
Biggest failure? Man, I feel like... I think this is getting obviously personal, so I feel comfortable sharing with you. We're all friends here. Just, you know, like, I feel like I failed in terms of my relationship with my mom for a long time. Like, I was really close with my dad when he was alive, and I always confided in him, and I always kind of deferred to him as the person to talk to and the person to lean on. And not to say, like, I have a great relationship with my mom, but it took my dad passing for me to realize, like, how badly I had failed as a son with her. Like, I missed out on so much with her at the time, or over a period of time. And I wish I would have taken advantage when I had the chance. But, you know, like, I feel closer with her now than maybe I ever have, which is great. I mean, I'm sorry it took, you know, my dad passing to realize that, but I always thought that was a big failure of mine as a son, just not enjoy that and not to take advantage of that for a longer period of time. And now I feel like I'm playing some catch up, but it's, like I said, it's a good place to be and it beats the alternative.
Absolutely. Seven, what habit or quality do you think has contributed most to your success?
I think being flexible. I think people appreciate when you're willing to adapt to them and you're, And that goes for, like, that word means a lot of different things. And I think being flexible with people, being flexible with whatever hurdles come in front of you on whatever path you're on, I think that's important. Being able to adjust to different elements, to different problems, whatever it may be. Like, it could be as simple as being at the airport and your flight gets canceled and you have to figure out, you know, what's the best way to get to where you need to go. It could be I work with a different person from broadcast to broadcast, and you need to be flexible in terms of how you deal with other people. I think that's been, I think, a really strong asset that's helped me a lot along the way.
Number eight, have you ever been in a fist fight?
I mean, I don't know if I put up much of a fight, but yes. I think swinging awkwardly at somebody is I guess, constitutes being in a fist fight, but I have been in a fist fight. I've only been in one, and it did not go very well for me.
I love that. Just swinging, flailing away counts. I'll give it to you. Number nine, what's the thing about yourself you'd most like to improve?
I think not taking things personally. I think most people, especially in the age we live in, and I would say you probably deal with it so much, Sarah, like just being an opinion maker and a pundit and somebody who is going to put themselves out there in, so to speak, in the line of fire. I mean, it's just Twitter or whatever, but you know, that's the line of fire that we're often in, and the subjects of public scrutiny. And I know you deal with that a lot. I think you've probably learned that it's not always personal. People just want to be angry. Sometimes people just have knee jerk reactions, and you're the quickest and most accessible outlet for them to, voice their displeasure with whatever it is that you said. So realizing that it's just kind of part of the territory sometimes is important. So I think not taking things personally and not taking things to heart when there's no necessity to do so, I think that's something I want to be better at as a person and as a professional.
Finally, what three words would you most hope people would use to describe you?
Everybody thinks they're funny. I hope people think I'm funny. Like I hope that's one of the things that people remember. I hope I make them laugh once in a while. I think generous, whether that's with time, whether that's money, whatever that may mean. I hope people feel like I tried to take time or to contribute for somebody else. I hope people feel that way. I hope they think I'm generous. And empathetic, I think, is the other one. I think, like, I love that word. I have a tattoo on my body it's actually from Kurt Cobain's Suicide Note, where he ends it saying peace, love, empathy. And empathy has always been, like, a really important word to me, because I feel like it's not the most important quality to have, but somebody who doesn't have that quality.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's definitely up there. And if you don't have that quality, like, it's hard for me to invest in you as a person. And I think it's just so important. It's a very attractive quality in a human being to have. So I hope that's what people think of me as. I try to put myself in other people's shoes before I judge them. I try not, or maybe not judge, maybe I don't, you know, not, don't judge at all if you can help it. But I hope people think of me as somebody that cares about where other people are coming from before I make any assumptions about them.
And finally, the bonus, who should I have on this podcast?
I've talked about it in the past, and like, he's helped me spur some memories and write about some things. I think Peter Burns, who's one of our colleagues at SEC Network and ESPN, he's got a tremendous story. Adopted from a very diverse background, he told me he didn't know a single member of his blood related family until he had a daughter, and that's an incredible story to me. And professionally, he's got an incredible journey to go from a job that he loved that he got fired from, and he thought that his life and career were over, to, you know, a few years later getting to do what he's doing now. I think he's an inspirational dude and a compassionate and empathetic guy. I think that's a great guy to talk to.
That sounds awesome. I'm on it. Hey, thanks so much for hanging out with me, Adam.
You're the best, Sarah. Appreciate it.
Oh, And another thing.
This week's That's What She Read is a story by Brian Windhorst on ESPN.com about LeBron James Foundation and the school he just opened in Akron. And I'm sure you've heard a lot about the school and maybe even skimmed over the headlines, but I recommend reading the full story and some of the details about the school itself. It has a longer school day, a longer school year. The educators are going to be tasked with doing much more than just educating, trying to overcome some of the disadvantages that the attendees face at home. They have breakfast with their teachers at the school, and it's really an experimental space, a public school for at-risk students. And he's not the first athlete that we've seen open a school. He's not the first athlete to do incredible things in his community. But the specifics of what he's trying to do with this I Promise school and how he's looking back at his own life and what challenges he faced and how he might make things easier for the kids coming after him. It's just really incredible. So I recommend reading the story. The headline is LeBron's Legacy in Northeast Ohio Includes a Title, Disappointment, and Hope. It's by Brian Windhorst on ESPN.com. Thanks as always for lasting about an hour with me.
That's what she said.